I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's October 11th, and we have a lot to talk about. And as we're getting into the flu season now, it's a good time to be talking about vaccines. People living with MS often have questions about whether a particular vaccine is good for them or whether it might carry with it the risk of a relapse or other negative health consequence. Joining me today to brief us on all things related to vaccines and MS is Dr. Lisa Doggett. Dr. Doggett is a family doctor based in Austin, Texas, and she's also the senior medical director at HGS Access Point Health. Dr. Doggett was a 2021-2022 Vaccine Science Fellow with the American Academy of Family Physicians, and Dr. Doggett has lived with MS since 2009, all of which makes her more than eminently qualified to discuss how vaccines affect people who are living with MS, which vaccines are important to get, and which vaccines are the ones you should avoid. But before we get to my conversation with Dr. Lisa Doggett, there are a few other things that you should know about. At the beginning of this month, I attended the 2022 National Conference on Caregiving Research, hosted by the National Rehabilitation Research and Training Center on Family Support at the University of Pittsburgh. And I think my single biggest takeaway from 2 days of outstanding presentations and conversations is that caregiving is a social determinant of health. And in case you're not familiar with the term social determinant of health, the CDC defines social determinants of health as conditions in the places where people live, learn, work, and play that affect a wide range of health and quality of life risks and outcomes. Social determinants of health often come up in conversations about healthcare in underserved communities. For example, some members of minority populations may not receive cancer screenings because there aren't any healthcare providers or facilities in their communities that offer cancer screenings. And this, of course, can lead to higher numbers of cases of cancer being diagnosed among individuals in these communities. Now, you wouldn't say that this outcome is due to any physical condition that these individuals might share. It's a function of the neighborhood in which they live, a social determinant of health. Getting back to the Caregiving Research Conference, there's evidence that shows being a caregiver means you're less likely to visit a doctor for your own medical needs. It means that you're more likely to experience clinically significant levels of depression and anxiety, and it means that your life expectancy itself is shorter than someone else who isn't a caregiver. Over the course of the conference, one presenter after another made the case, either explicitly or implicitly, that, by definition, the act of being a caregiver must be considered a social determinant of health. As someone who spent 23 years as a caregiver, this sobering conclusion got my attention because I could personally attest to its logic and its validity. Now, I certainly recognize that many of you who are living with MS are living with minor symptoms, and perhaps you can't even imagine ever needing a caregiver. Of course, I hope that always remains true. But our listener survey tells me that about half of you are living with progressive MS, and that means that some of you already have a caregiver in your lives. My working hypothesis is pretty simple. Caring for the caregiver leads to a better outcome, a better day-to-day quality of life for the caregiver, and therefore for the care recipient. Acknowledging caregiving as a social determinant of health sets the stage for solutions that are designed to offset the negative impact on health and well-being that caregiving can cause. And perhaps because there are now millions more caregivers among us than ever before, we're seeing those solutions begin to appear and gain greater visibility. It's clear that people are starting to pay attention. Just a couple of weeks ago, the first national strategy to support family caregivers was released. The strategy includes nearly 350 specific actions the federal government will take to support family caregivers, while also offering 150 practical steps that states, communities, and private industry can take to help build a system that ensures family caregivers will have the tools at hand to maintain their health, well-being, and financial security. November is National Family Caregivers Month in the United States, so we'll be taking a closer look at the national strategy to support family caregivers then. In the meantime, if you'd like to review the plan, you'll find a link in today's show notes. In what seems like a very appropriate follow-on to talking about caregiving as a social determinant of health, results from a recent study in the United Kingdom show that family caregivers have a 33% higher risk of future illness and disability compared to people who aren't caregivers. Now, the researchers in this study set out to measure the effects of chronic stress on the future health of individuals. Chronic stress is stress that endures, stress that stays with a person over a prolonged period of time. And the research team realized that there really wasn't a practical or ethical way to expose study participants to chronic stress. So they thought about finding an identifiable group of individuals who were already experiencing chronic stress. And that's how they settled on family caregivers. Now, they focused on a very large population-based data set in the United Kingdom and selected individuals who reported that they were caring for someone either inside or outside their home. These individuals had also reported the number of hours that they provided care, and the researchers matched these individuals to people of the same age and gender who had not reported any caregiving responsibilities. Then they compared the two groups of study participants by analyzing an index made up of cardiovascular, metabolic, and hormonal dysregulation that each individual may have experienced. Through this process, they ended up with two groups of study participants with matched age and gender who all seemed healthy and disease-free. Finally, they looked to see whether the healthy caregiver group reported more illness or disability than the healthy non-caregiver group 8 years later. Specifically, the research team focused on chronic health conditions including heart disease, diabetes, or asthma. And they found that 24% of the caregivers reported one or more of these health conditions, none of which had existed 8 years earlier, compared to 16.5% of the non-caregivers who reported one or more of these health conditions. These study results have broad implications, and they add further evidence to drive forward support efforts and programs designed to help family caregivers better manage the stress of caregiving and better balance their lives. Because once a caregiver develops a chronic illness themselves, well, you quickly realize that now you have two people who require care. And too often, there isn't another caregiver waiting to take over that assignment. Now, if you'd like to review the details of this study, you'll find a link in today's show notes. People affected by MS have had a long-standing interest in how diet might have an impact on MS. But the challenge of conducting research on the effects of any specific diet is the same challenge that people face when they're trying to adopt a diet for themselves. It's hard to stay on a diet. And when participants in a diet study go off the diet being studied, well, I think you can see the difficulty there. But that's not to say there isn't research being done. And the results of a small phase 2 study conducted at the University of Virginia show that a ketogenic diet reduced weight, fatigue, and depression among people living with clinically stable relapsing MS. Now, as a quick review, a ketogenic diet, or a keto diet, is a high-fat, low-carbohydrate diet that's often used to treat hard-to-control epilepsy in children. In this study, 65 people with stable relapsing MS spent 6 months following a ketogenic diet. They had their adherence to the diet monitored daily by ketone testing, and 83% of the participants adhered to the diet for the entire 6 months. The research team measured fatigue, depression, and quality of life scores at the beginning of the study, and then at 3 months, and again at the end of the study at 6 months. The outcome showed significant improvement in MS quality of life scores, as well as significant improvement in mental health. Study participants also experienced an improvement in their EDSS score, that's the Expanded Disability Status Scale, that's used to measure disability among people with MS. There was improvement in the 6-minute walk time and the 9-hole peg test that some of you may be familiar with. Researchers also noted an increase in the vitamin D levels of the study participants. Now, this study isn't without its limitations. First, this was a small study, and there was no control group established to compare these results with. And the only participants in the study were those people living with clinically stable relapsing remitting MS, so there's no way to determine whether the results would have been the same or similar if the participants included people with more active relapsing disease or progressive MS. On the other hand, the outcome of this study shouldn't be ignored. Instead, we should see larger phase 3 trials that include controls and account for the different subtypes of MS. If you'd like to review the details of this study, you'll find a link in today's show notes. If diet is one hot-button topic among people affected by MS, stem cell therapy is the other one. And in past episodes of the podcast, we've talked about studies that have shown autologous hematopoietic stem cell transplantation, or AHSCT, to be effective in slowing MS progression, reducing relapses, and improving the quality of life for people who tend to reflect a specific profile. That is, they're under 50 years of age, they've been diagnosed with relapsing MS for 10 years or less, and they haven't experienced significant levels of disability. But we haven't heard much about how AHSCT affects tissue damage. And when you recall that MS is a disease in which the myelin sheath that protects nerve fibers is damaged, understanding the impact of AHSCT on tissue damage in the central nervous system seems important. And so a research team in Sweden set out to do exactly that. They analyzed the liquid that surrounds the brain and spinal cord. This liquid is called cerebrospinal fluid. And they wanted to determine whether the markers of nerve damage in this cerebrospinal fluid had changed following AHSCT. The scientists looked at 3 different protein markers in the cerebrospinal fluid that are associated with nerve damage in the central nervous system. One of these protein markers is called neurofilament light chain. One is called myelin basic protein. And one is called glial fibrillary acidic protein. Long names, but what it all means is that the elevated presence of these proteins in the liquid that surrounds the brain and spinal cord is regarded as evidence that there's been damage to nerve fibers in the central nervous system. The research team studied 43 people who were living with relapsing remitting MS, all of whom had undergone AHSCT between January 2012 and January 2019. The average age in this group was 31. And 80% of the study participants had been on at least 2 disease-modifying medications prior to receiving AHSCT. All 43 people had samples of their cerebrospinal fluid taken prior to receiving their stem cell treatment. 26 people had samples of their cerebrospinal fluid taken 2 years following their stem cell treatment, and 8 people had samples taken 4 years following their stem cell treatment. No one in this group had received any sort of MS disease-modifying medication after their stem cell treatment. And 4 years later, 21% of the group had experienced some form of disease activity. 4 people had experienced an MS relapse, 5 had developed new lesions, and 5 people in the group experienced disability worsening. In analyzing the levels of the 3 proteins in the study participants' cerebrospinal fluid, the researchers initially found high levels of 2 of the proteins, neurofilament light chain and myelin basic protein, in about 2/3 of the study participants. After AHSCT, these protein levels continually dropped until 5 years after AHSCT, the levels of these proteins were considered normal. Now, the level of the 3rd protein, the glial fibrillary acidic protein, that remained fairly consistent both before and after AHSCT. Now, before receiving their stem cell transplant, the baseline markers for the 3 proteins correlated very closely with each person's EDSS score. But in the years following AHSCT, that association no longer existed, which demonstrated that the process of demyelination had effectively been stopped. Once again, this was a small study, and the number of participants became glaringly small in the 4-year follow-up. But the results shouldn't be overlooked. Instead, larger trials are needed to determine whether, in fact, AHSCT not only improves certain aspects of MS, but whether it ultimately stops the destructive process of demyelination. If you'd like to review the details of this study, you'll find a link in today's show notes. AHSCT continues to show tremendous promise, but it hasn't yet established itself as the sure thing that some folks make it out to be. The good news is that there are other stem cell therapies also being studied, and these studies are also reporting encouraging results. What is a sure thing today is that getting the flu is not much fun, nor is getting shingles or a host of other illnesses that can all be prevented through vaccination. Dr. Lisa Doggett joins me today to talk about the vaccinations that you should absolutely get if you're living with MS, as well as the vaccinations you may want to avoid. In a moment, we'll meet my guest, Dr. Lisa Doggett. It's the start of the flu season in the United States, and that makes it the ideal time to review the safety and importance of routine vaccinations for people living with MS. This conversation is perhaps more important right now, given the availability of the new COVID-19 Omicron booster. Joining me to talk about vaccine-preventable infections and provide vaccine recommendations for people living with MS is Dr. Lisa Doggett. Dr. Doggett is the Senior Medical Director of HGS Access Point Health, LLC, and a family doctor based in Austin, Texas. She was a 2021-2022 Vaccine Science Fellow with the American Academy of Family Physicians, which was funded by a grant from Merck, Sharp, and Dohme Corporation. Dr. Doggett has lived with MS since 2009, and she's written a memoir, blogs, and articles about her MS journey. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Doggett.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Getting vaccinated to prevent harmful infection is a fundamental part of medical care for everyone, including people with MS. Experts from the American Academy of Neurology recommend that people with MS should receive vaccines according to standard vaccine guidelines. So let's dive right in. What can you tell us about the safety of vaccines for people with MS? And perhaps you can also explain what those standard vaccine guidelines are all about.
Sure. This is such an important topic, and I'm glad to be able to talk with you about it. Things, you know, are always a little different for those of us who live with MS. But fortunately, vaccines are safe for people living with MS. Getting vaccinated, in fact, is one of the most important things that we can do for our health. But there are just a few caveats to consider. I know we're going to talk about some of those. You asked about the guidelines, and there are some really excellent recommendations that the American Academy of Neurology issued in 2019 about vaccines for people living with MS. They recommended that those of us with MS should generally receive all of the standard vaccines. They also reviewed some safety considerations and certain circumstances that can impact vaccine safety or effectiveness. And they mentioned a little bit about timing as well. Guidelines are also put out by the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and those are updated annually. They can be found on the CDC website, which is really an excellent resource. But of course, always discuss with your doctor when you're making any vaccine decisions, especially if you're taking immunosuppressive therapies.
Are there certain vaccines that people with MS should always be sure to get? And I'll ask you the flip side of that question. Are there any vaccines that people with MS should avoid?
So this is a really important question. There are multiple different types of vaccines and I'll kind of talk about each of them. In general, most vaccines are safe and can be given to people with MS just like anybody else. But it depends a little bit on the type of medication that you're taking. So first of all, there are inactivated vaccines that are used to kill. They use actually a killed version of the germ that causes the disease. So an example would be the flu shot that we know we need to be getting right now, as well as the hepatitis A vaccine. There are also recombinant vaccines that use key pieces of the germ, like a protein, a specific protein, that trigger an immune response. These include like hepatitis B, pneumococcal, or shingles vaccines. And then there are the mRNA vaccines, such as Moderna or Pfizer COVID vaccines. And we hear a lot about these right now. And these vaccines work by teaching our cells to make a certain protein in order to create an immune response. For most people with MS, all of these types, the inactivated, the recombinant, and the mRNA vaccines are safe. They're not going to trigger an illness that they're meant to prevent. In contrast to that, we have the live or the live attenuated vaccines. These are a weakened form of the germ that causes the disease. Examples of these in the United States include the MMR, measles, mumps, and rubella vaccines. There's also varicella or the chickenpox vaccine and rotavirus. But, you know, fortunately, most of these vaccines are given to us as kids. There's also a live vaccine for flu, an intranasal flu vaccine, and these generally should not be given to people with MS. There's a small risk with these live vaccines that we could be causing the disease that we're trying to prevent, especially if the immune system is weakened. This is more of a theoretical risk, but it is something that we need to consider. So that's why we generally avoid live vaccines if someone is immunocompromised. And that may not be everybody with MS. Again, it depends on your therapy. So you want to just talk with people, with your physician before you make any decisions, especially about a live vaccine. And you can usually adjust the timing of the vaccine or the timing of the therapy to make it work if necessary, weighing those risks and benefits with your doctor.
Can being vaccinated trigger an MS relapse?
We don't think so, but there's no evidence at this point that that's the case. The studies are limited, so I think it's important to be honest about that. There is certainly a concern that the diseases that we're preventing by the vaccines could trigger an MS relapse. And in general, it's very much thought that getting the disease is much worse, a much higher risk than actually having the vaccine. There's a little bit of a concern that a vaccine could cause a relapse that's already going on to be prolonged or to be worse. But again, we just don't know yet. So it's recommended that if someone's already having a relapse, you would delay the vaccine until that relapse is no longer active, usually weeks later. There's also a concern with medications like steroids that are used to treat a flare of MS, and that might make the vaccine less effective, not so much a safety concern.
COVID-19 is going to be a part of our world for at least the foreseeable future. So it's important for everyone to keep informed about the latest COVID-19 vaccines and the latest COVID-19 boosters. I'll first ask you the question that I always like to begin these conversations with. Are the COVID-19 vaccines safe for people with MS?
Yes, the COVID vaccines are safe in people with MS, and they are strongly recommended. They are not live vaccines. They protect us from hospitalization and death, and serious side effects are very rare.
Is it safe to receive a COVID-19 vaccination or booster while you're on MS disease-modifying therapies? And what are the special considerations that people might want to keep in mind when it comes to the timing of that vaccination?
So yes, it is safe, but there are some special considerations. So for those of us who are on MS medications, we need to be aware that the timing can be important. Studies of people with MS who are using B cell depleting therapies, such as ocrelizumab, show actually a better antibody response when the vaccine is administered 3 months or more after their last dose of treatment. Ocrelizumab is given every 6 months, so you'd want to wait generally 3 months after that infusion to get the vaccine. The timing recommendations are not because of safety, but they're there to help ensure that people have the best response to the vaccine. And I think that's really important. It's not a concern that you're going to be getting sick from the vaccine. It's just that you want to increase the chances that you're going to have a good immune response and not get that infection in the future. I also want to mention the National MS Society has some really good guidelines that are pretty easy to follow on their website. So that's a good thing to check out, as well as, of course, talking with your doctor.
The Omicron booster is now available at pharmacies and health centers. Can you tell us how this booster is different than the last booster?
Yes, thank you. Over the last 2 years, the COVID virus has mutated. Not too surprising. It's unfortunate. This is what's happened to cause those new outbreaks. We had the Delta variant last fall and then Omicron over the winter. And what that means is that the earlier vaccines are not as effective against newer strains of the virus. That's why we're seeing breakthrough cases. Vaccine makers, though, fortunately, have been working to create new formulations of the vaccine, and that's where we're getting this new booster. So the new booster is an Omicron-specific booster that targets the two subvariants that are now very common, responsible for most cases in the United States, and they also cover the original virus. So it's very important that all of us get this new booster as soon as we can.
And that brings me to my next question. Who is eligible to receive the new booster? And who are the people who should be getting it as soon as possible?
So the new booster is recommended for anyone who's 12 and older. It's generally given 2 months after the last vaccine, whether that was a booster or the completion of the primary series. Boosters are especially important for those of us who are immunocompromised, either because of medication or because of some other medical condition.
As I mentioned at the top of this episode, we've officially kicked off the flu season in the United States. So let's talk about the seasonal flu vaccination. Should people living with MS receive a flu shot every year? And if they should, when is the best time to get it?
Yes, absolutely. Everyone with MS should get a flu shot every year. In fact, everyone who is 6 months and up should be getting a flu shot every year, whether they have MS or not. It's really important for all of us to get it unless there's a specific reason, like an allergy, not to. And true allergies to flu shots are very uncommon. For most people, it's best to get the flu vaccine now, September or October, to make sure that they're protected throughout the full flu season. And I think if you have somebody with MS in your household, but you don't have it yourself, living with someone with MS or another chronic condition is another important reason to get that flu shot and stay caught up with it every year.
I heard you answer this question earlier in our conversation, but I think it's worth repeating. The flu vaccine is available as a shot and it's available as a nasal spray. Is that nasal spray vaccine the same as a shot? And is it safe for people with MS?
Great question. I'm glad that we're circling back to this. So the nasal flu vaccine is actually one of few live vaccines in the US, and it's generally not recommended for people with MS if they're using a disease modifying therapy. So for most of us who have MS, and if we're using treatment for that, an injectable flu vaccine is generally preferred.
Should women living with MS who are pregnant still get that flu shot?
Absolutely. In fact, pregnancy is one of the conditions that increases the risk of severe illness from flu. Flu can actually be harmful as well to a developing baby. For example, fever is a common symptom of flu and has been associated with some adverse outcomes. So getting vaccinated during pregnancy protects the mom, protects the baby during pregnancy, and then it also protects the baby afterwards in the first several months because antibodies from the mom pass on to that baby and can continue to protect the baby. I strongly encourage women who are pregnant to get the flu vaccine. Very, very important.
And since that newly approved COVID booster is also available right now, is it safe for someone with MS to get that booster at the same time that they're getting their flu shot?
Yes, I think that's a great idea to get both at the same time. They're generally given in different arms, but there's no concern about administering the COVID shot or a flu vaccine at the same time or with any other vaccine. And a lot of people are behind on another vaccine. So get them all over with at the same time. I think it's a good plan.
I'll ask you about two other important vaccines. The shingles vaccine is recommended for adults who are 50 years old and older. Is this vaccine safe and recommended for people who are living with MS?
Yes. The shingles vaccine is an important vaccine for people with living with MS, especially if you're taking a disease-modifying therapy. There's a fairly new shingles vaccine called Shingrix. It's much more effective than the previous version called Zostavax. It's generally two doses given 2 to 6 months apart. There's a chance that it may not be quite as effective in people with MS who are on certain medications, just like some of the other vaccines we talked about. But in the general population, it's over 90% effective at preventing shingles and preventing postherpetic neuralgia, which is a very bad, painful condition that can occur and last for years after a shingles infection. So again, it may not, maybe not quite as effective in those of us with MS, but certainly worth getting. It's actually not just recommended for people 50 and older, but for those who are 19 and older who have a weakened immune system because of disease or therapy. So MS specialists are increasingly recommending that Shingrix vaccine to people starting or who are currently taking immunosuppressive therapy, regardless of age.
And what about pneumonia? Pneumonia can be a pretty serious illness, especially for older adults. Is the pneumococcal vaccine recommended for people who are living with MS?
So the pneumococcal vaccine is actually important for everyone who's 65 and older or for people that have certain underlying conditions. Pneumococcal disease is an infection caused by a bacteria called pneumococcus. This can include pneumonia, as you mentioned. It actually can include meningitis or bloodstream infections. And the pneumococcal vaccines help protect us against that pneumococcal disease of any kind. And it's recommended, as I said, for adults 65 and older. The American Academy of Neurology recommends people with MS get it as well if they have another underlying condition, but also if they have compromised pulmonary function or lung function, including those who use a wheelchair or those who are confined to a bed.
Well, Dr. Lisa Doggett, thank you for everything you do to improve the lives of people living with MS. Thanks for sharing some very timely information with us, and thanks for talking with me today.
Thank you so much. And before we go, I just want to put a shout out to Dr. Leora Freeman, who's an MS specialist here in Austin, who helped me prepare for this talk. She was a big help, and I'm really, really glad to be here today to share this information with you.
That's going to wrap up this episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society. And you can share this episode of the podcast by letting your friends or family members know that all they have to do is point their web browser at realtalkms.com/267. You'll find that link in today's show notes, so you can easily copy and paste it right into an email or a text. And if you have a minute, I hope you'll visit the Apple App Store or the Google Play Store and download the free Real Talk MS app for your iOS or Android smartphone or tablet. It's the best way for us to stay connected. The app will automatically download the latest episode of Real Talk MS. You'll be able to access any of our past episodes. You'll be able to save your favorite episodes. And it's a great way for me to share bonus content with you. The app is free, so I hope you'll download it today. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and make healthy choices.